It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this first half hour is retired U.S. Army Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. During his 31 years in the Army, he served in the Vietnam War, also in Korea, Japan, and Hawaii. Wilkerson served as Deputy Executive Officer to General Colin Powell. That was when Powell commanded the U.S. Army Forces Command. Also Special Assistant to Powell when he was Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Then, after retiring from active service in 1997, Wilkerson served as Secretary Powell's Chief of Staff at the U.S. Department of State. That was from 2002 to 2005. Currently, Wilkerson is the Distinguished Visiting Professor of Government and Public Policy at the College of William and Mary. He is in Iowa this week, speaking at several locations. Last night at Iowa State University, tonight, I believe, at Drake University, and Friday in the Iowa City area. The title of his talk, Governing Under the Influence, Are Pentagon Contractors Driving U.S. Foreign Policy? He joins us from our studios in Des Moines. Colonel Wilkerson, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You talk about corporate influence on foreign policy. I wanted to talk about that in just a moment. But because we have former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testifying as we speak, I wanted to get your view on the current proceedings before the House Select Committee investigating Benghazi. Where do you stand on the two versions of this? Is this a well-meaning, needed investigation or a political exercise meant to tarnish Hillary Clinton in the polls?
This is a political exercise meant to tarnish Hillary Clinton in the polls. I mean, we've even had members of my party, and due diligence here, I'm a Republican. We've had members of my party who have actually said that. We've had, an Air Force officer who was working with the committee come out and say that he was fired because he objected to the concentration on Hillary as opposed to the real purpose of the investigation. So it's a political exercise.
And this is coming from someone, if I may break in here, you are intimately acquainted as a special assistant to Secretary Powell when he was the Secretary of State. You know all about the exercise of power, what they can and can't do in a certain situation.
I do, and that's also what I teach. I teach the exercise of power, particularly in the post-World War II era, through the mechanism of examining presidential decision-making. And I have to say that Chris Stevens was an extraordinary ambassador. He was very courageous. He wanted to see what was going on. He was willing to risk his life to do that. And I have no qualms about what he did. I have some qualms about what the Congress is doing now to make that death a political issue rather than an issue of tragedy, which it surely was.
Colonel Wilkerson, you think Pentagon contractors are wielding too much power over U.S. foreign policy. You've come to Iowa to speak about that, among other things. We'd like to believe that the Pentagon budget is decided in the public's best interest, not for private profit, but you're saying that's not the case. Tell us what you mean and how that influence is exercised.
Let me say, first of all, that it's not just the Pentagon. Corporate influence in general, big oil, big pharmacy, big food, big real estate and banking and so forth. The latter we've seen the results of here rather graphically in the last decade. All exercise a pernicious, insidious influence over presidential decision making, over what this country actually does domestically and internationally. The Pentagon budget is only a portion of this influence, and it's actually bigger under the rubric of national security. In fiscal 2013, for example, the American people were taxed and spent $1.2 to $1.3 trillion for this idea of national security. The Pentagon was only about 500 plus billion of that. You've got the nuclear program at the Department of Energy. You've got the Veterans Administration program, which most Americans don't know is completely separate from DOD and growing every day because of the bulk of veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. You've got the State Department 150 account, that's international relations spent on national security. And you've got the intelligence budget, which for 17, yes, 17 intelligence entities from the DIA to the CIA to the DNI is now well over, if it were published, $100 billion. So you've got $1.2 to $3 trillion in fiscal 2013, and there's no change really in 14, going out to this issue of national security. Most Americans don't know that. is a tremendous amount of money, and it is money that, by and large, is not spent with any strategic purpose in reality and is spent a lot of times on things like, for example, the F-135 or the F-35 Lightning fighter that we're working on right now, the most expensive airplane in the history of the world, that are largely just to keep the defense contractors alive and breathing and very rich, thank you very much, rather than the nation's national security. The F-35 won't even perform up to the specifications the Marine Corps, the Navy, and the Air Force have put on it.
Mm-hmm. So how do we arrive at military spending that is more appropriate?
I think you could cut if you put what I just described to you together and you called it a national security budget, and you looked at all the categories of that budget, and you even had a joint committee in the Congress called the Committee for National Security. Great name. And it just looked at this not through stovepipes, but with national security in mind, Homeland Security, DOD, everybody. If you had that, you could probably save, and this is not an exaggeration, we have done the figures in Washington. We've done the audit of those figures, $100 billion a year for the next 10 years. That's $1 trillion you could save on this defense budget, and you're only just starting because you're beginning to look at it holistically. And incidentally, as you look at it holistically, you can shift money in those accounts, like, for example, shifting some of that hard power money to soft power like diplomacy, and you can make a difference in the United States' reputation, power, and its pursuit of its interest in the world. And you could do it quickly, and you could do it far more cheaply.
Mm-hmm. How many allies do you have that have this view in Washington who could put forth this idea? And is this idea out there among those decision makers?
It is. And there are quite a few allies. As you might suspect, there aren't too many in the Congress and there aren't too many in the White House because they've gotten caught up in this power game that they play in trying to convince the people that vote for them and give them money so they can run for office that they're still on their side, many of whom are advocates of Lockheed Martin and Grumman and Boeing and Raytheon and a host of others. And I haven't even mentioned military contractors who have become a significant and essential component of the American war-making capability. We had more contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan at one time than we had soldiers and Marines. So this is a huge component of this influence. But there are many people who realize this. Many of them are in the military, like myself, having been in the military, and who would like to see this corrected because it's not very good for the security of America.
Okay. You were part of this whole – your career speaks of the military complex here, the war-making ability of this country. Was there a moment that changed your mind? Why are you saying what you're saying today now?
I think I began changing my mind when I was a major, and I essentially was responsible for what we now know as the Hummer, the high mobility multipurpose wheeled vehicle, the Humvee as we call it in the military. I came to Washington as a young major to brief a Senate committee and its staffers, more importantly, the real power, on this program. It was a $400 million program for a TOW missile, anti-tank missile carrier for the airborne infantry in the military. I was told by the committee, with a snicker and a laugh, go back to Fort Benning, Georgia, and develop a program that is big and that will mean a lot of money for a lot of people, and we might buy it. Your little $400 million program, we're not going to buy. I went home, developed a $9 billion program for 59,000 vehicles, replacing every quarter-ton to three-quarter-ton vehicle in all the services, and we got the Hummer, and I sold the program. That's when my eyes began to open to the fact that, hey, this wasn't necessarily about national security. It was more about jobs, and it was about keeping defense contractors warm and happy and about keeping congressmen who were supported by those defense contractors in office.
Mm-hmm. And it really doesn't matter, doesn't of the two major parties – whether it's Republicans at the helm or
doesn't matter a bit.
Doesn't matter a bit. No?
No. The Democrats seem to have a little less tendency to support the military establishment in the sense that we've just described it than the Republicans. But bottom line, the Democrats are just as guilty as the Republicans when you come up with the budgets because I think the Democrats wanted to reestablish their bona fides in the national security issue. You know, my party had pretty much had that in poll after poll for years, essentially since George McGovern ran as the Democratic Party's candidate for president, they lost the national security issue, if you will. And so they've regained it now. They regained it largely with, I think, Bill Clinton. And Hillary Clinton is no exception in that vein, in my mind. She'll try to maintain those bona fides. So you've got this camp that can't get out of this embrace. And it includes the president himself or herself. They simply can't get away from this military-industrial complex. Dwight Eisenhower warned us of this in January 61 when he made his farewell address, but there was a speech he gave earlier that, in my view, was even more poignant. He essentially said, this is no way of life at all, describing what the military-industrial complex can do to the American Republic. This is no way of life at all. Indeed, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. That's a powerful metaphor, and this is coming from a five-star general, arguably one of the most iconic figures to come out of World War II. And he's telling us that this is a pernicious influence in every federal office building, in every state house, indeed in every home in America. This is not someone walking out the door and saying, oh, by the way, America, you got a problem. This is a person telling us, warning us in 1961 and before 53 and throughout his presidency that this was something that we needed to be careful about, and we haven't been very careful.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen the nature of what you see as this threat or this problem change? We're talking about a vast, period of time in our history, in our lifetimes, from the 50s up until the present day. Has its nature changed?
It has. It's gotten much worse. In fact, if Dwight Eisenhower were here today, I suspect he would be appalled at how little his warning has been heeded and at how accelerated has been the progress of the danger that he predicted. It's simply to proportions today that call for war more often than peace. And let me tell you what I mean by that. We've just seen, and we're still in, a period of what appears to be interminable war. We're dropping bombs in Syria. We're killing people with drones right now. And anyone who says that's not war is just smoking something. This is war. When you kill people for the state, it is war. And we're doing that, and there seems to be no end to that.
But the idea, if I can just put the other idea, is we need to attack them there on foreign soil, before they grow and come here to further attack our home soil.
There's so much politics of fear associated with what you just said that it's difficult for me to parse it. There have been fewer people killed through terrorist attacks in this country since World War II. That's a pretty long span of time, as you just pointed out, than have been killed in one single year by automobiles on the highways. There have been fewer people killed by terrorist attacks in this country since World War II than we kill every year through domestic gun violence. We have, through domestic gun violence, a 9/11 times 10 every year, 30,000 plus victims. We have spent $2 to $4 trillion, depending on whose estimate you count, on counterterrorism to this point. We haven't spent that money on these other two things. This is preposterous.
Retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, my guest this half hour, speaking live. He's the former Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. He's in Iowa this week, speaking on a number of occasions. He's now Professor of Government and Public Policy at the College of William and Mary. We have a few more minutes to talk here. You've threaded your comments a little bit with talking about candidates, politicians, of course. I'd like to get your thoughts, Colonel Wilkerson, on the 2016 presidential candidates. We've been experiencing them a lot here in Iowa, and I assume, is that also why you've come to Iowa? Because Iowa plays such a pivotal role in our selection process.
It is. I was in New Hampshire earlier for the very same purpose. I have to say that I agree with the London Financial Times. I believe it was Mr. Silverman on their op-ed page who declared the current array of Republican candidates a freak show. I think that's a pretty good description of it.
And you are, to say again, you identify yourself as a lifelong Republican?
I am a lifelong Republican.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So give us your thoughts. It sounds like you want to talk about the GOP candidates here. What have you seen in the last few weeks tells you which candidates strike you as having the best understanding of foreign policy and the threats facing the U.S.?
I have to say, just from my foreknowledge, and not necessarily from these debates, but I think the person that in the Republican lineup, if any of them impress me at all, I have to pick Jeb Bush, and I pick him not simply because of his performance to this point, in fact, decidedly not because of that. I pick him because I served his father, H.W. Bush. I served his brother, George Bush. Really served Dick Cheney, I think, in that capacity. He was really the president of the United States for those first 4 years. And I understand that Jeb comes from a long line of people who understand U.S. policy since World War II, understand multilateralism, understand internationalism, understand using the United Nations for its purposes, and so forth. I haven't seen that demonstrated, but I know the phenomenon. I saw it with Mitt Romney. I know these people have to speak to the radical right in order to keep them, the so-called base, and then they have to become more central when they get into the general election.
Mm-hmm.
I've also listened to John Kasich. He makes a lot of sense, and I know his credentials in budgetary affairs, and that's something we need desperately because we're driving ourselves to bankruptcy, partly because of this military-industrial complex. We have printed $4 billion in the last couple of years. We just printed it. We didn't create products of value and sell them to someone. We didn't do things that normally are attributed to a sound and robust economy. We printed this money. The world is moving right now because of that and other actions on our part to balance and eventually replace the dollar. One of the Chinese strategic objectives is to make the renminbi the currency of choice, if you will, the transactional and reserve currency in Asia, and then spread it to the rest of the world. And by golly, they're making enormous progress in that vein. Watch what happens to this country when we no longer have the ability to print money the way we have the last few years without creating 1,000% inflation overnight. It's a pernicious situation, and we're not dealing with it correctly.
Colonel Wilkerson, we unfortunately have just a few minutes left. I'd like to get your thoughts more on the candidates, if we could, in the last 3 or 4 minutes we have right here. Still in the GOP column of candidates, do you see candidates that you find making very concerning comments or ignorant comments about foreign policy and threats?
I certainly do. I see Donald Trump making absolutely inane comments. I see Ben Carson making comments like Muslims can't be trusted. Does Ben Carson know how many Muslims have taken the oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and are in the ranks of the U.S. Armed Forces?
You do, I bet.
I do. And I tell you, it's I've gotten emails from some of them, lieutenants and captains and sergeants, who say, how can someone say this and not be corrected at a minimum and thrown off the stage at a maximum? How do you answer someone like that who's serving his country in Afghanistan or somewhere else? And they don't understand this. Well, we've been through this before. We went through this for 400 years with black Americans. We're still going through it with black Americans. This kind of vile comment does not belong on a presidential platform. It doesn't belong anywhere, in my view, but it certainly doesn't belong on a presidential platform.
Okay, we've got a couple minutes left. I'd like you to look at the Democrats that are vying for the White House. You mentioned Hillary Clinton already. She's the leader in the polls. Also Bernie Sanders there, high in the polls as well. What do you see in the Democratic column when we evaluate them in terms of foreign policy and threats facing the U.S., national security threats?
I see the only one with a viable chance for the White House as being Hillary Clinton, and I'm somewhat concerned about that. While I have a lot of respect for her, and that respect comes mostly from my having watched her from the State Department when I was there act as a senator. She was very collegial. She knew the issues. She was prepared to cross the aisle. She was prepared to compromise. Our Assistant Secretary of State for Legislative Affairs, with whom I met virtually every day, told me that she was, in his estimation, and he was a Republican, one of the best senators on the Hill. So I know she has the capacity to govern. I know she has the capacity to do things reasonably well. But I'm worried about the circumstances under which she'll have to do them. I'm worried about anybody getting into office for that reason. I like some of the things Bernie Sanders was saying, particularly about the maldistribution of wealth in this country. It is worse than it has been since 1929. Read Thomas Piketty's book, Capitalism in the 21st Century, if you want to understand how bad it is. So some of the things the Democratic candidates were saying resonate with me. I do think they had a much more sane and sober debate than any of the Republicans so far, and I was impressed by that. I don't like the way the media, the corporately owned media, the CNNs and MSNBCs and Fox Newses of the world, think they can regulate these things and orchestrate who in the end will become president of the United States. But I think the Democrats got beyond that, and I think they had a reasonable debate. I wish my party could do something similar.
Okay. In the last minute or two, tell us your views on how President Obama has met foreign policy threats or not during his time in office, now that we're nearly 7 years into his term.
I haven't seen him and wouldn't have expected him to have the capacity to escape these tendrils that I'm talking about, the military-industrial complex, big oil, big food, big banking, and so forth and so on. I haven't seen a lot of independent action that would impress me that, one, he had a strategy, and two, he knew how to carry it out politically and otherwise. There's some things I've been impressed with. This latest joint comprehensive plan of action with Iran, the permanent 5+1, Germany and Iran on the nuclear deal, very successful diplomatic effort, which if it comes to fruition, and I'm worried about my people in the Congress derailing it even yet, but if it comes to fruition, it will be the signature achievement of his administration, and it will bring peace to a relationship that had every potential to start another war for the United States in Southwest Asia, in the Middle East.
Okay. So go ahead, finish your thought.
No, I was just going to say I think he's done some things well, but I haven't seen him escape this environment, which I've just described to you.
Mm-hmm. If you could leave us with one question, Iowans going out to meet the candidates, talk with them in gymnasiums, town halls, and wherever they meet, from you, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, do you have a question, one question that you think is well-placed in posing to these candidates about national security and foreign affairs?
I'll do like all questioners and say I have two questions. One is, how are you going to get the United States out of this period of interminable war? And two, how are you going to make the wealth situation in this country more balanced?
Okay. Thank you very much for your thoughts. Retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Chief of Staff to U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up in our second half hour, from our fields to our dinner plates to our waistlines, the meat industry shapes our lives, and we'll talk in just a moment about the challenges facing our meat-eating society. Several colleagues of mine from Harvest Public Media will be with us. They've been involved in bringing you the series we've been hearing this week on Iowa Public Radio called Choice Cuts, Meat in America. What are your biggest concerns about the meat you eat? Join our conversation after this short break, 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.